What I love about public humanities is it is built on this principle of all of us are fascinated by these big questions and what it means to be human and how I can build deeper connections with my neighbor, with others in the world who are asking big questions, and how that might change my civic engagement, my sense of self. There's so many things that we wager on the humanities, and to deny or to have people who feel that their access to that has been denied is a real tragedy.
I'm talking today with Devin Apts, Research and Operations Director for the Clemente Course in the Humanities, an organization whose mission is to provide transformative educational experiences in the form of free college courses for adults who face economic hardship and adverse circumstances. We'll speak with Devin about her work for this organization, but our primary conversation will be about Devin's work as a theologian, and specifically her insights into the poetry of the innovative English Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins. Hopkins is known for his creative, truly ingenious use of language, and Devin will help us understand how the rhythms of Hopkins' poetry underscore the tempo of spiritual transformation and reveal the dynamics of God's grace. I'm Matthew Wickman of BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute. So Devin, we've been talking about recording a podcast episode for a long time, and I've been slow in pulling it together. It's great to finally have the chance to talk.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation. It's really wonderful to be here.
Well, it's great to have you in. We spoke a couple months ago in person at the National Humanities Conference that was held this year, I guess last year would be, in Providence, Rhode Island. It was back in November. And it was a great conversation we had, despite, I think, some really quite mediocre food from the mall. Why we decided to go to a mall, it's kind of beyond me now, but that's how it ended up. So eventually we're going to talk about your current work as Director of Research and Operations for the Clemente Course in the Humanities. And we may also talk about the organization that introduced us to each other, which is the Christian Poetics Initiative, which was created by David Mahan of Yale Divinity School. But first, I've wanted for a long time to talk with you about the late 19th century English Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, and specifically about a chapter you wrote in a volume titled The Art of New Creation, published a couple of years ago. The chapter on Hopkins is, for you, it's not a one-off thing, right? You've written pretty extensively about Hopkins.
Yeah, that's right. So this chapter is actually kind of a distillation of one of the core arguments from my doctoral thesis, which I finished in 2019, and which is on Hopkins, kind of exploring theological aspects of his writing that hadn't really been explored before. And the funny thing about this chapter is, as I say, it's one of the core arguments that I'm making in the thesis itself. My thesis is obviously larger in scope and in its claims, and I'm now preparing that for publication as a manuscript. But it was one of those humbling scholarly experiences where you realize that actually 5 years of research and 200 some pages of an argument can perhaps be distilled into something much more pithy and brief.
I've been there, had that experience. At least you could publish it. I've had the experience of working for a long time with something and thought, this is unpublishable, right? Who would want this, right? So yeah, you're a step ahead of me in some cases. Yeah, you know, now really quickly on your background here. So you got your PhD, you wrote on Hopkins at King's College in London, right? What's your course, your education, quickly for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So I did my undergraduate training at a very small Christian liberal arts college in Massachusetts called Gordon College. And there I was a literature and language student, and also gained quite an appreciation for the arts in general, but very much through the framework of faith. In fact, all of my undergraduate and master's level training was in institutions that foregrounded faith as a key part of learning. After Gordon, I went on to Yale Divinity School and studied religion and literature there. So always through this lens of how theology and literature speak to one another.
Okay, and then King's College. And I, when I read your article here, the chapter in this book, The Art of New Creation is the book title, and your chapter title, In God's Good Time, Poetry and Rhythm, Poetry and the Rhythms of New Creation. When I read this, I thought, man, it's a very smart piece. It's also, I found it expansive in the way that a lot of discussions that do incorporate sort of faith and ... right, can be expansive, you know, faith and the arts, faith and literature, faith and, you know, sociology or psychology. I found it very expansive and meaningful. My question, I guess, I want to ask you at the outset, why focus on Hopkins, right? So you did all this work across, you know, sort of three institutions and three different degrees, and I assume you enjoy reading Hopkins, as do I, but I'm not asking this as a casual question, you know, why Hopkins? I'm really wondering what it is about Hopkins that not only drew you as a student, and not even what drew you to write a book manuscript, but what it is about Hopkins that compelled your attention as a modern reader. You know, what it was in Hopkins that seemed urgent to someone like you who lives in a different time and place than he did.
Oh, this is such an exciting question. It could be answered, I think, in so many different ways. But I think a huge part of what draws me to Hopkins is actually this very affective quality of his writing. So I feel like Hopkins has this ability to really speak right at a listener, and his poetry, as we'll probably get into, should really be heard rather than read on a page. And he calls this, actually, he has a name for it, he calls it bidding. And it's the sense that his manipulation and the connections he draws between sound and sense are so strong that it really speaks to the reader in a pretty unique way. And I think Hopkins is fairly consistent in maintaining that that is because he's listening to something that is actually already present within language. And so in that sense, his poetry really grows out of everyday speech. And yet it's got this reputation of being very dense and difficult. So what you find in Hopkins is this wonderful paradox between, I can hear, enjoy, and on some level really understand what is going on in this poetry. And then in another sense, it makes these incredible demands of me as a reader. And I think some people have found those demands really off-putting. Hopkins had for a long time a reputation as a difficult writer. He's still difficult when you're coming to his work for the first time. But I find it to be an interesting spiritual discipline to attend with care to Hopkins's poetry. It's been very important for shaping my own thinking, and especially because he writes out of these quotidian speech rhythms, it also then rebounds on how we engage with ordinary language. So his poetry really trains me to hear the extraordinary in the ordinary, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah. I love that phrase. It trains us to hear the extraordinary in the ordinary. I think that's profound. Let's turn to your chapter, right? Again, it's titled In God's Good Time, Poetry and the Rhythms of New Creation. And the chapter takes up the passage in Ephesians 5 in which the writer is traditionally Paul. It's either Paul wrote it or someone who was steeped in Paul's theology wrote this chapter. But this is where Paul, or the Pauline writer, encourages us to, and I'm quoting here, walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time. It's a provocative passage in Ephesians. And I'm wondering whether it's a passage that you'd contemplated for a long time, or was it really the occasion of writing this chapter that drew you to this passage?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. So I should say, first of all, that my interest in this particular verse from Ephesians 5 was absolutely piqued by a very important essay by Jeffrey Hill that I reference and discuss in this chapter. And the title of Hill's essay is Redeeming the Time. Hill does not, and this is a very Hillian move, he doesn't exactly go into much depth. I believe he maybe doesn't discuss at all the reference to Paul's letter to the Ephesians. But as a theologian, I am really interested in how this idea of redeeming the time might speak to our reading of literature and the way that literature might be engaging with the redemption of time. So Ephesians 5 is, just to provide a little bit of context, it's this passage within Paul's letter where he is taking on an apocalyptic tone, warning about evil days and providing instructions to the emerging faith community at Ephesus to really live out their patterns of love with each other and walk as children of light in the midst of darkness. So it has this very apocalyptic tone, but is not apocalyptic in the sense of a coming judgment. And in fact, the very recently late Richard Hayes, a wonderful New Testament scholar who died, I believe, last week, he speaks about this passage as a not future judgment, but awakening into moral consciousness. So what I love about that is this idea that what one is awakening to is something already present, either a demand or a possibility or an opportunity to participate in redemption. There is this sense of awakening to that. And I think so the passage really speaks to both the already and not yet of the strange time pattern that we live in as people of faith, but it also then speaks to, but you can bring that already and not yet forward into a time where we are participating in the redemptive work that is already taking place.
I love that. I love that insight into the participation of something that is already taking place, but that requires in some way for us to be alert to it, attuned to it, awakened to it, to be fully participating in it. In other words, it can be happening, but it's not fully happening for us unless we are conscientious, aware, attuned, which is what you're suggesting, which Hopkins' poetry does for us precisely.
Yes, yeah, I think that's right. And I think Hopkins' poetry does that. And I think Hopkins is unusually attuned to it. So I think probably what I love the most about poetry and its possibilities for theology is the way that it heightens our attention to exactly these things. The way, again, coming back to that sense of the extraordinary within the ordinary, there is nothing more intimate and quotidian than language, than speech, but it's also this thing that's very unusual and very surprising and touches on the transcendent, I think, more than we usually admit.
Yeah, you bet. It's really a fascinating thing. I mean, I'm thinking about the ways that literature participates in all this kind of dynamic. We'll get into this more in a minute, but what you said and what you say in the article about the rhythms of it. I mean, it's very familiar to hear a conversation and like a literary discussion among scholars about how literature, through its imaginative quality, helps us to imagine a different kind of a space than ones we're currently living, which I think is a true claim. And for many, many writers, it's very, very apparent. But you get into the actual kind of the texture and rhythms of speech as though that were the medium for this transcendence, not just what the work kind of helps us to imagine as being something other than what we presently experience, which is what I find so fascinating about your article.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's right. I really love the way that literature, and especially I should say poetry, which is more my wheelhouse than fiction or nonfiction, I think that it really has this quality of not simply conveying through the meaning of words, the semantic meaning of words, but through the way that they're combined and all those rich variations of language that poets are so gifted at heightening for us.
Yeah. Now, you said that the backdrop for this insight in your chapter, right, what you're talking about right here, was the COVID-19 pandemic. And you write in the chapter that this precipitated, I'm quoting here, a seismic disruption to our lived experience of time. And I was talking with a colleague the other day and wondering about the lingering effects of the pandemic on my life habits. Have you detected any lingering effects in yourself? I mean, here we're removed from COVID now for a few years. Do you still detect its traces in how you kind of live, move, think, feel, in ways that make these kinds of poetic effects you're describing that much more urgent?
Yeah, absolutely. This question makes me laugh whenever I hear it. To give a bit of an unserious answer, in a sense, doing a PhD followed by a long period of social distancing just obliterated my social skills. So I certainly feel that lingering effect. But in all seriousness, I certainly feel that it has changed the pattern of how I live. It's made me more aware of cycles of time and certainly health, and I think that is something that the generations that are coming up now are going to really feel for a long time, but I certainly feel it in myself. It also has brought to me in the years since we've kind of moved out of the pandemic, a heightened awareness of my own failures of attention. And truly, I do think that I write quite a bit about the things that I struggle with personally, and I know that I could always use a little bit more attention myself. So certainly that's something that I feel. I wonder what you and your colleague found to be the lingering effects for yourselves.
Oh yeah, listen. Working at a university, for example, I one of the things that you see is just a very different sense of social obligation or lack thereof when it comes to things like events you're holding on campus. And so we still have many events at BYU, and we have, you know, good audiences for them. But there is a sense, I think increasingly people have that. They've cut away things that they don't find essential. And that's, I think, to the good, but often what we think to be, what we find to be inessential, are things that actually are really important. We just don't have the bandwidth at the moment for them. So there's a, I think it loosened a sense of social obligation. And I'm not sure that's entirely come back. I was talking yesterday with a woman in my neighborhood, talked about her young adult children now in their 20s, and how she's noticed that the pandemic had really kind of devastating effects on them. They were finishing college during the year seasons of the pandemic, and how difficult that was on them. So I think that the effects are wide. And what you mentioned, wiping out your social skills, I think that a lot of people kind of felt that. And I think it also, in some ways, eradicated a sense for what the importance of community actually can be, and why it's not just the kind of thing that is as casual as liking a song on Spotify, but why some things, that have kind of moral obligation attached are actually really significant and not just opt in or opt out.
Yes, absolutely. And gratitude for when genuine community is possible. I think that's something that I feel to a profound degree since we were in a situation where gathering was not possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me go into here the Hopkins language. Now, Hopkins is famous for the terms inscape and instress, right? And these are terms I don't think he invents. He employs them. But he never, as you point, he never expressly defines them. Okay. Now your chapter takes up these terms inscape and instress, and it presents us with a picture of what Hopkins means by these terms. Now, inscape, as I understand it, is the distinctively kind of divinely created form of a thing, especially of things as you confront them in their kind of otherness, right? Their remarkable peculiarity that makes them what they are uniquely. And instress is kind of a force that binds all these individual things together. Am I on the right track?
And I love that you described it as a picture of what Hopkins might mean by these terms, because you're absolutely right that he does not offer us any clear definition, much as different scholars have tried to provide those over the years. There's an increasing and actually quite well-established consensus at this point that we don't really know what these terms mean. Nevertheless, I think that they do give us a picture into something that is quite important for Hopkins, which is this relationship between the particular and the universal. So, how does my interiority communicate to others? How do I express that to others? And then, how do I receive and find some kind of empathy with the interiority of those who communicate to me? And that doesn't simply mean creatures for Hopkins. It doesn't mean humans exclusively. It means all of creation is constantly communicating. Creation is deeply communicative to Hopkins. So really a literal sense of even the rocks cry out, but they cry out not simply to God, but to all of creation, to bear witness to that interiority, that very specific thing within themselves that makes each thing unique. And then this in-stress is this thing that makes it possible to interpret and receive that.
Okay, you connect in-stress in your chapter to poetic stress, right? Which is an important point, right, for the larger argument you're making in the chapter. And you claim that all this discussion of inscape and in-stress is part of a spiritual vision of Hopkins's, right? It's a manifestation of God's grace, and which I find really provocative. It's a very compelling insight. And I'm wondering how you understand the role of grace here. Like, how does Hopkins understand it? And is the way he understands it the same way that you understand it?
Yeah, this is a really wonderful question. Just to find our way into this point about how Hopkins conceives of grace, and its connection to stress. So for stress, Hopkins defines it in a letter as the making of a thing more, or making it what it already is, making it more markedly what it already is. I think what leads me to make this connection between grace and stress is that he also speaks about grace operating in that very specific way of making something what it already is. So, Hopkins wrote actually a ton about grace in his spiritual notes, in his sermons, and then you see it all over his poetry as well. And he really conceives it as a divine gift, which is very common in Christianity. And this gift is quite specifically bestowed in order to enable creatures to imitate the pattern of self-sacrifice that is set by God in Christ, and that will enable the creature to live more fully into life, so enjoy the fullness of life that God intends for all creatures. And grace, in that sense, is a bestowal of life, but it works by sacrifice. And the key for Hopkins, I think, and this might be what sets him apart a bit from other 19th century theological thinkers, is that he really conceives of grace as always available. There is no distinction here between grace and nature in Hopkins. I think that's something that is very significant for 20th century theology that Hopkins can offer. Even when grace is hard to perceive, it is still always there. And it is this sense of heightened attention, trying to perceive it even when it's difficult. But in some ways, this reflects what Karl Rahner describes as grace being the inescapable setting of our existence, which I think is a lovely description of grace. And that, for me, that does resonate with how I tend to think about grace as this thing that is always available, this gift, and it is literally the gift of life. Christian theology teaches that we owe all of existence to the gift of life that God gives us. It's always available. It is literally the setting in which we have our existence, but also if we turn off our attention, we might miss it.
That's really beautiful. It's a beautiful vision. I was thinking as you were talking about that, it reminded me of that verse from the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus at the end of chapter 5 of Matthew, "Be ye therefore perfect," right? And perfect there that is not a perfection as a by some kind of standard that's strictly external. It's not like grow into being something that you're not. You fallen thing into something other than you are. It's more like become whole in what thing that you are. Become a perfected whole thing that thing that you are, which is possible only through grace. And as you're describing,
Yes.
it's the kind of thing that's always there if we're properly attuned. It's a beautiful idea.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's such a challenging verse in so many ways,
Yeah.
even when you understand that underlying kind of message within the language of what Matthew is writing about. It's to the injunction to be perfect is so challenging. Even if you turn off your mind to grace at any moment, it's you fall away from that. And the fact that it is always there is the gift, and it's the comfort to us as those who are striving for the kind of perfection that God intends for us, that it is a present always available when we are able to perceive and to tap into what it can offer.
That's a great response. And I appreciate, by the way, your noble restraint. As a theologian, when I raise this verse out of the blue, you're kind of like, okay, Matt, I could say about 5,000 things here. So many which would undercut what you just said, but thank you for that. Can we discuss how this actually works in Hawkins' poetry? In your chapter, you take up a long poem, their famous poem, The Wreck of the Deutschland. And this is what kind of it's known in literary circles as the poem where Hopkins develops mature poetic style, you know, kind of sprung rhythm, which is another kind of conversation. That's part of this conversation too. But I wonder if we could just for illustrative purposes for a podcast, read a shorter poem and talk about how grace works through it. And I'm thinking about the poem, the sonnet, God's Grandeur, also a famous Hopkins poem, known to many of our listeners here. Do you have this poem? Would you read it for us?
Absolutely. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod. And all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. And wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, O morning, at the brown brink eastward, springs. Because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with awe, bright wings.
Thank you so much. So if I were discussing this poem in a class I teach, right, this is hypothetical, I might point out a few things at the outset. We might talk about poetic form, for example, the division of the lines. There are 14 lines here in what you just read. There is a first 8 lines an octet, then the last 6 lines a sestet, which has a certain kind of sonnet form to it. Typically, in that kind of form, you know, you have a problem or situation, a condition described in the first 8, and some kind of transformation or change in the last 6 lines. In this case, the solution is that the Holy Ghost broods over the world, that God still abides with the world, right? I might also, in a class, I might talk about the images of the poem or its rhyme scheme, this kind of thing. But in your article, you turn us specifically to rhythm. And I'm wondering what that attention to rhythm yields in a poem like this one, a poem like God's Grandeur.
Yeah, this is a wonderful question. All of those things absolutely contribute to the meaning of this poem. Hopkins is a masterful user of the sonnet form in exactly the way you describe. He is really exceptional about presenting a problem and then finding its solution. But often what you find is that that solution is also registered rhythmically. So what I love about this poem is in the first 4 lines, you get this really expressive, energetic image of the whole world being charged. What a wonderful kind of ambiguous term that can speak to so many different meanings. But you start out with this very almost standard iambic line, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. And it's lovely in its expressiveness in that harnessing of the iambic rhythm. But then in the next line, you get something totally different. An iambic pentameter would be the usual expected rhythm of a sonnet. But then we have, it will flame out, this what Hopkins would call kind of a sprung expression, so two stresses right next to each other. And that really captures this energetic, almost explosion of fire or of this light that shakes off of the foil as it shakes. Or The gathering to a greatness. So this extension of the rhythm in those lines that feels like oil is being crushed out of the words themselves. And then when we come into the latter half of the octet, those first 8 lines, what we have is a shift again in the tone, and it's registered rhythmically. So the question is posed, why do men then now not wreck his rod? Why do men not heed this presence of God within creation? And I love this next line because of how dull it reads against the ear. It's intended that way. Generations have trod, have trod, have trod. And it's such a bland expression, and trod really lands on the ear quite heavily. There's a real density to it. And then he goes through this list of things that are kind of thrown off of they throw off the scent of God's presence within creation. So whether that's our trade, the toil, the way that we cover all of the sensuous beauty of creation with our own selves, and in the sense also that the foot cannot feel anymore, having been separated from the direct contact with the soil. All of that is registered in these beautiful rhythmic kind of disruptions throughout. And then what you find in the sestet is a revivifying of the rhythm. So, and for all this, nature is never spent, this sense that we kind of elevate on the rhythm at the end of that line. And the dearest freshness, deep down things. Again, it's not the dearest freshness of deep down things. Hopkins was a fan of, why do I have to write in a way that I wouldn't necessarily speak? So there's this liveliness to the rhythm that grows again out of quotidian speech, out of everyday language. And then you come to the final line again with these heavily sprung lines of, the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with bright wings. That sense of surprise at the end is just lovely. So rhythm is doing a lot of the work, again, making it a very affective experience for the listener, but also working with the meaning that's conveyed on every level, I think.
Bravo, that was beautifully done. Yeah, that was terrific. And just you said something there toward the back. I'd never thought of this thing in the poem, but I did right here. When you said this, that line, there lives the dearest freshness deep down things. You point, it's not the dearest freshness of deep down things. That would suggest there are things that we can't actually see, that there's somewhere else to be seen, where the dearest freshness deep down things is. No, we can see them, but we don't, unless we attend to them properly, we don't recognize what's deepest down in those things already and present. Right? So the rhythm brings out these qualities in our everyday experience. It's not as though we have to get to someplace else. It's that the someplace else is already implicit in what is around us. The grace is already implicit in what is around us.
Yes, exactly. And that grace through this, I've used this phrase a couple of times, through a kind of bestowal of life, which is a wonderful expression that I've borrowed from the liberation theologian John Sobrino, who speaks about spirituality as an act of love for your neighbor that begins with turning towards suffering, recognizing that the suffering of others is making a claim on myself. And then the response is love, but not in an abstract sense. It's love in this form of a bestowal of life. And what I love about that is it says that we are participating in an action that is really God's action, and it's already in play. But what you are doing is you're harnessing love in a way that bestows life, that continues the action of God in God's gracious bestowal of life at creation and in the redemption of the world. You're participating in that redemptive act. And this way that life is bestowed on language by poetry and a poem like this does tap into that sense of, okay, that grace is already there. It's already in action. We simply just have to find ways of harnessing it.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love it. Thank you. In this poem, which you spelled this out really beautifully here, and what you kind of articulated for us with the poem "God's Grandeur," is that the kind of thing that one sees elsewhere in Hawkinson's poetry? Or are there important, you know, rhythmic variations that yield different kinds of insights into the meaning and the nuances of grace?
Yeah, I love this question because I think that this is, in some senses, you see a pattern across Hopkins, and I'll come to that in a moment. But one of the things that is so wonderful about what he calls sprung rhythm, which is his form of prosody that he claims to have kind of invented, this sense of growing out of everyday speech, is highly flexible, but it is conditioned by certain rules. So for example, he has something that he calls the principle of equal strengths, where the first half of a line should have the same strength as the second half of a line. This is far too technical. It turns out I'm a giant prosody nerd. so I won't bore your listeners with that for too long, but I think a really good example of another way that you see this sense of bestowing life on language and packing as much vitality into his lines as possible would be the poem Carrion Comfort, which is one of his terrible sonnets. And that is a poem that is the poet, or the speaker of the poem, I should say, really wrestling with the temptation to despair, which is a temptation to feast on the carrion comfort of one's own misery. And sense of desolation, isolation from God. But what's so interesting to me about that poem is that while the subject matter is very much about a tendency toward decay, a tendency toward inertia and death, actually, the poem itself is vital. Not, I'll not carry on comfort, despair, not feast on thee. It's got this deep vitality to the rhythm. So it's there's a sense in which the poet is struggling against that temptation, and the resistance to it is registered rhythmically, even when there are moments in the poem where he seems to be coming close to giving into despair.
Nice. Yeah, I'm gonna paraphrase here, kind of channel Agrippa, what he said to Paul, to you. Almost, Devin, thou persuadest me to be a formalist. Okay, that's a fantastic insight into these poems. I love it. So thank you. This has been a great lesson for me today. Now you outline a beautiful vision, not only of Hopkins's poetry, but we've been talking about this today. This divine grace pulsing through the world and our human experience of it. And this is a vision of how God is present in our endeavors, even when we may not be conscious of that presence. Now, in your case, that brings me to reflect on the fact you have a day job doing something other than writing about Hopkins. And this is your job as Director of Research and Operations for the Clemente Course in the Humanities. So we've got two questions here. Can you tell us about what the Clemente Course is first? And second, given that Hopkins helps structure your spiritual imagination, do you find God's rhythmic grace in your work with the Clemente Course?
Yeah, thank you. So let me tell you just first of all a little bit about the Clemente Course, as you ask. So we are a higher education nonprofit that offers free college accredited humanities courses to underserved communities, and especially to communities of people who have never had access to that kind of education. We operate at this point as a network of about 30 programs nationally and overseas. And our model is built on a recognition that the barriers to higher education are vast and multifaceted for many people. So in addition to providing really top-rate education, we also offer crucial wraparound services to our students, whether that's transportation or childcare. Many of our programs offer meals on the evening that the courses run. And the whole goal of the organization is to do everything we can to provide access to the humanities for all. Our core belief is that the humanities should be for all people. And the reason why I love your question so much about connecting up my research with what I do for the Clemente Course is that this pivot into public humanities has been a pretty big shift for me. I was previously at a seminary, and that was a wonderful experience. But what I love about public humanities is it is built on this principle of all of us are fascinated by these big questions and what it means to be human and how I can build deeper connections with my neighbor, with others in the world who are asking big questions, and how that might change my civic engagement, my sense of self. There's so many things that we wager on the humanities, and to deny or to have people who feel that their access to that has been denied is a real tragedy. So what I love about working in this sphere of public humanities is it is again trying to bring something very ordinary, very intimate and universally experienced, this desire to know and to engage with deep questions, and trying to make that more immediately accessible to those who might not otherwise have thought it was accessible. And as it turns out, our students are really excited and engaged, and unsurprisingly, they are just glad to be in a room where they can ask questions that haven't been asked before in their communities and read texts that they would have thought might not be immediately available. And to me, that feels like a lot of what I've discovered Hopkins doing with poetry, but within the wider sphere of the humanities, trying to make what is already there and already within somebody's grasp more accessible and give them the tools for understanding it.
That's so great. I love it. It's a great description of kind of the virtues and the meaning of this Clemente course. And it has, you know, we talked before about this when we had lunch a couple months ago about your work, but putting it in the in light of what you've been talking about with Hopkins and grace, you know, kind of turning our attention to things that are already there, that have such meaning if we're able to attend. In this case here, the attention that you make possible is helping people have get access to, you know, the humanities, access to these texts, to these ways of thinking, these conversations, these topics, and they're already there, just they're not always easy to channel. And making that more possible is like it's a formally speaking, it's like an extension of grace, which I think is beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, it feels like a real privilege to operate in this sphere, I will say.
Now, I mentioned at the outset of this conversation, you and I met through the Christian Poetics Initiative. Can you tell folks what this initiative is and what brought you to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned our mutual friend and colleague, David Mann, who is a scholar of religion and literature at Yale Divinity School and the founder of the Rivendell Institute, which is an organization that is loosely affiliated with Yale, but that has a particular kind of focus on theology and the arts, and specifically this Christian Poetics Initiative, which is aiming to see what Christian lenses can bring to the study of poetry in the 20th century, 21st century. And David is such a gifted and thoughtful human being and has really made an effort to foster deeper conversation across those who study religion and literature, writers, people who are just broadly interested in these intersections, but then also folks at different career stages, which I am so grateful to David for that because he's really helped to elevate those of us who are still getting our career off the ground, and to have more mentorship. So one of the things that I really enjoyed, and you and I currently are in a group where you and David are co-mentoring those of us who are studying literature and religion in our own context. I think we have a few writers among us, some theologians, some literary scholars. It's a really wonderful community that David is bringing together of scholars and practitioners.
It really is, and he is quite the marvel. And he has a, I think what he's trying to do is a very important thing in itself, making a place for these conversations around Christianity and literature, the arts, et cetera, theology and the arts. It's important, and they're conversations that are not easily had across all sectors of the humanities. In that respect, what he's doing with CPI, Christian Poetics Initiative, is not unlike what you're doing with the Clemente Corps, though for a different cohort of thinkers and scholars and interested readers, and which I really appreciate about David. I'm so glad you've been in the group. That's how we got to be talking. I read your essay before you were ever in the group that I'm in with CPI, and I thought, boy, this is great. And now I get to talk to you about this. So I've appreciated that. I want to conclude by asking you about something you write in your essay on Hopkins. Go back to that, I guess, for a minute here. It's where you evoke what you call our diseased social imagination, which is a great phrase. And you elaborate on it this way. You say that this social imagination of ours, quote, serves existing systems of power rather than the needs of God's beloved creation. In light of present circumstances, Christians are called upon to consider what it might look like to embody the rhythms of the new creation as a mode of protest against such moral and spiritual inertia. Mm-hmm. All right, so I love this thought. And I try to embrace it. I try to live in a way that, you know, kind of reflects it. But, you know, you and I, we live in a moment when Christians are widely seen not as antidotes to disease, systems of power, but often as manifestations of those social ills. And I guess I'm wondering how one differentiates, how you differentiate your own faith commitments from the kinds of corrupt systems that, you know, we see all around us. Local, cultural, political, etc.
Oh, you're not letting me end on a very easy note here.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Do you like chocolate? Is it yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Done.
Not that's fine. This is such a hard thing, I think, and I think one of the things that is most important these days is for Christians to really honestly reckon with harms that we have done as a community within the world. The only thing I can say is try to do better, or not even try, but simply to do better. And for me, what I have found very important in my own later faith development, more recent faith development, is making a distinction between the institution and the body of Christ, the church as an institution and the church as the body of Christ. And for me, that means really investing in my local church, which also happens to be the church where my husband is the priest. I'm an Episcopalian, and being part of a community that is practicing its spirituality in ways that feel authentic and life-giving to not just to myself, but actually to the world. But certainly I think we have a lot of reckoning to do as a faith for harms that have been done and ways that we haven't always lived up to that high calling that the scriptures make on our lives.
Yeah, I agree. That resonates for me. It's kind of a reminder to me. I saw recently a documentary about the French philosopher René Girard, and the documentary is called Things Hidden. And someone asks Girard a version of this question, you know, how could you be Christian when blah, 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 blah. And his response is just like, well, what's needed is for us to live our faith in ways that are more authentic and fuller. And that and that a lot of times, a lot of the problems that people have with religion is that the people who profess it aren't necessarily ones that exemplify what it means to live it as far as they can tell. And so I think that the more conscientiously one lives it, which is also, as you would point out, is to recognize our own implication in sinful deeds and natures, and to seek grace more fully, seems to me to be a way to live more fully into a more dynamic, expansive, and meaningful and fuller world, where there's space made for everybody, all of God's creation, not just people, but all of God's creation, broadly speaking.
Absolutely, and I think, I must talk about this phrase. I certainly think about this phrase more than just about anything else. That sense of bestowal, love being the bestowal of life, has been really important for me, and it gives kind of a concrete language for what love can look like when it is done in cooperation with the work, the redemptive work of grace, I think. So striving for that in whatever form it might take. For me, actually, a huge part of that has been learning to garden, teaching myself the skills of raising plants from seeds. But there can be less literal ways of cultivating life, and there are all sorts of things that we can be doing as a community to live out that kind of an ethic.
Love as bestowal of life. I'll take that phrase from our conversation, and gratefully so. Thank you so much, Devin, for your work and your time and your insights, your inspiration. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for your very thoughtful questions. This has been a real delight.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.